Straight out of Scotland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Edinburgh. What can we actually say about God? Can I make positive claims about God, such as God is perfectly loving? Or can I only describe God in terms of what God is not like, such as God is not weak or God is not ignorant? In today's episode, I sit down with Simon Hewitt to discuss something called apophaticism, or negative theology. We chat about the apophatic approach to speaking of God and some of the implications for theology, the problem of evil, and politics. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here is Simon and I speaking positively of negative theology. Enjoy. All right, so Simon, I'm doing a series of episodes on rival models of God, and I want to take listeners through arguments for and against different models of God. So in the series, we're currently looking at classical theism. And so one part of the classical tradition is something called apophaticism. So why don't you start by telling us what apophaticism is?
Okay, so apophaticism comes from a Greek word meaning to deny or denial. And I think an important thing to hold in mind about apophaticism is that it is not primarily a philosophical position. I'm going to talk for most of this podcast as though it is. But if you look at the Christian thinkers, and it's the Christian thinkers I'm most familiar with, who we describe as apophatic, mostly what they are doing is preaching or praying or otherwise doing something practical, encouraging people to shed inadequate images of God. So apophaticism is, if you like, stripping away inadequate or idolatrous images of God in order to be united to God and to one another. Having said all of that, I'm a philosopher. I get paid for coming up with theories, not for stripping away inadequate images of God per se.
Sure.
And there are clearly philosophical ideas implicit in apophaticism. Roughly, what I would call apophatic theology is theology that proceeds by denying things of God, by saying that there are severe constraints about what we can truthfully or even coherently say of God. So it's kind of a humble, cautious way of doing theology. My own work focuses on what sometimes gets called ineffability, so literally the idea that God is unspeakable. And the way I'd cash that out, and you need to be pretty careful to avoid paradox here. The way I'd cash that out is we cannot say what kind of thing God is. So in ordinary everyday life, we encounter things and we contain them under what philosophers call a kind. So I can see you, Ryan, and you're a human being. And because you're a human being, I can make all sorts of inferences about you.
Right.
You're sitting on a bed. These are the kind of conditions philosophers do podcasts in. And I know about beds and I can say all sorts of things about beds. I can make inferences on the basis of the kind of thing your bed is. God is not like that. And that's the headline news. In slightly more technical and slightly more archaic terms, but these are the terms someone like Aquinas would have been working with, I cannot give a real definition of God. So a real definition for ancient and medieval philosophers is saying something like, you're a rational animal. That's what it is to be a human being.
I've tied
down what it is to be a human being by containing you under what's called a genus. And a species, you're a rational animal, and you're this particular rational animal. And because of that, I can say all sorts of things about
Right, yeah.
I can't do that with God. That's the headline news.
Okay, so I want to make sure I'm following along here. So when I'm doing apophatic theology, I'm starting with, okay, well, I've got some different conceptions in my head about what maybe God's like. Well, if those are false conceptions, I have to get rid of those.
Absolutely.
And then the hope is then through getting rid of all these false conceptions of God, then I'm going to get closer and closer to God in a sort of way that's religiously significant.
Yeah.
So how do I go about justifying a position like this?
Okay, so that's an interesting question. I think any belief of the sort we might call religious, the kind of belief that is typically held because you're part of a religious community, there's kind of two basic sorts of motivation it can have. Within the Christian tradition, we'd sort of carve these up as faith and reason, right? So I might believe something because my religious community teaches it. it might think it's contained in the scriptures, or it's taught by authoritative figures, or it's traditional, or something like that.
Right.
On the other hand, I might hold it because of arguments that are, at least in principle, accessible to people outside the community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about myself, because I'm the easiest example of someone who assents to an apophatic theology. I think both sorts of reasons are available. So the church I'm a member of, the Roman Catholic Church, teaches something called the doctrine of divine simplicity, mm-hmm. which we'll come on to very soon, in fact, because I'm about to talk about it in the next bit.
Cool.
But it teaches that as part of the content of the faith, and I at least think that entails apophatic stuff. So I think there are quite strong faith-type reasons for believing it from my own perspective, mm-hmm. my own Catholic perspective. There are weaker kind of reasons. So significant figures in the Christian tradition have certainly held divine simplicity. So Augustine and Aquinas would be mm-hmm. the best known, I guess, Boethius, people like that. But there are figures who are pretty well known. So people like Meister Eckhart mm-hmm. or Teresa of Avila, who have been definitely uncontroversially apophatic.
Right, yeah.
Pseudo Dionysius would be another. So there's traditional reasons. But in terms of the rational stuff, which I suppose in philosophical context is of more immediate interest,
mm-hmm.
a very standard argument, so an argument that's kind of there in Aquinas, for example, goes something like this. What it is to be God? Well, we can't know the essence of God for reasons hinted at earlier. We can't mm-hmm. get a kind of real definition. But there's a kind of job description. God is the creator.
Sure,
Why do we believe in God? Why? Well, we believe that because there's something rather than nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that answers the question, why is there something rather than nothing at all, is God. So God's the creator. Okay. Does that tell us stuff about God? Well, it tells us stuff that can't be the case of God. It tells us that there can't be what we might call significant complexity in God. What on earth does that mean? Think about ourselves again. We're complex in all sorts of ways.
Right.
There are distinct existences that come together. So I have a liver and a heart.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the same thing.
Right.
They're parts of me.
Mm-hmm.
So God doesn't have material parts. That might not seem like headline news because God's not a material entity.
Right, and yeah, so most models of God are going to be happy to say, God doesn't have any physical parts. Yeah.
Exactly, but there are other types of complexity. So we have properties that are distinct from us. Mm-hmm. I have the property of having brown hair. It's very easy to see that's distinct from me because I very easily might not have brown hair. I could go home and dye it.
Mm-hmm.
God's not like that. And so on. I mean, people will talk about the distinction between essence and existence.
Mm-hmm.
So that I am and what I am are distinct. Because,
right, because I could have the idea of Simon without Simon actually existing.
And alas, the idea will exist after I have ceased to exist. Whereas God's not vulnerable to going out of existence like that. So the idea is, and this is what gets called the doctrine of divine simplicity,
mm-hmm.
which I know you've talked about and indeed worked on before. The idea is that those types of complexity cannot exist in God. Why? Well, says Aquinas, in kind of a quite almost an aside in the Summa Theologiae, mm-hmm. but I think this is an important argument. Those types of complexity stand in need of explanation. So essence and existence can come apart, as we've seen. Material parts needn't coexist together.
Right.
Properties needn't inhere in substances. So there's always an intelligible why question
mm-hmm.
if you've got that type of complexity. But God, if you like, is supposed to be the terminus of all sensible explanatory questions.
Right.
So there's a problem. So we ought to deny those things of God.
So I want to make sure I'm following at this point. So when I'm looking at apophaticism, how do I justify it? You talked about, you might have like religious reasons.
Yeah.
But the philosophical reasons are, well, whatever God is the explanation for why there's anything at all.
Yep.
And then now you're starting to like get really specific about, well, what sort of things need explanations? Well, all these things that have parts, all these things that are divisible. Well, God can explain all those. Well, if God has parts, well, then we need an explanation. It hasn't really bottomed out yet. I need an explanation for that.
Yeah.
And so if God's simple, well, then I don't need any explanations anymore now. I've got the ultimate explanation.
There's nothing that... There's both good news and bad news mm-hmm. at this point, of course. So I don't... It's not even that I don't need explanations. It's that I can't intelligibly ask for explanations. But for exactly the same reason, my language and my conceptual capacities brought to their very limit
mm-hmm.
the languages we use are equipped for talking about things in this world composed of complex entities.
Right, right.
For talking about entities where distinctions like the distinction between property and substance are intelligible. Just think about the... most human languages are set up so that we have what we might call subjects, so words like Ryan, and predicates, like is sitting on the bed. The very structure of our language is set up to describe and make inferences about the kind of things we've just said God isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the Oxford theologian Herbert McCabe put it like this, that our words wear second-hand clothes when they're used to talk of God. It's like things aren't very well equipped to do the describing task. So to go back to the direction of argument, it's from creation. And in a way, the atheists could follow this. They needn't accept that there is any such thing as creation, but, you know, God's... Yeah. If anyone does creation, that's God.
So, it's got to be God, yeah.
Creation, simplicity, and then because simplicity, the radical failure of our linguistic or conceptual resources, so apophaticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a pretty classical way of arguing. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm saying anything... Well, I'm certainly saying something radical in one sense, but
sure.
I'm not saying anything that breaks with the kind of classical Western tradition here.
Exactly, So it might be radical to contemporary ears, but for most of Christian history, this would be like, oh, right, we all know this is the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it always ought to strike one as radical and that one ought to be awed by the mystery of God, put it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a familiar path to being awed, put it like that.
Yeah. Okay, so now, in order to do theology, though, I need to say things about God. And so I guess I'm a bit worried at this point that this apophaticism leaves me with really not a lot to say about God. Mm-hmm. So if someone adopts apophaticism, what can she actually say about God? Because it almost sounds like all God talk would be nonsense.
So that's the concern, and indeed that is the charge that's brought by philosophers like Plantinger. I'm going to give a controversial answer and then a more helpful answer. So the controversial answer is good. I mean, we should be afraid of talking... Not nonsense about God. I mean, we talk nonsense about God all the time. We deploy metaphors. The Bible talks about God turning God's back. And it talks about God as a case of dry rot in one passage. So it's kind of fine to talk. That's religiously useful, helpful. Mm-hmm. That's part of our collective life together as religious people. But not talking nonsense, but talking idolatrously about God. So saying things of God that are unworthy of God or that make God out to be a creature in the world are dangerous. Not because, I mean, God can cope with that, but we often can't. And just think about the use of God talk to justify oppression, you know, God's on our side as we slaughter our enemies and so on and so forth. We ought to be hesitant in speaking about God because God talk, whether true or false, is powerful. So I quite deliberately do want to put the brakes and make us think. And that I think is both... kind of tradition I'm immediately influenced by, so that would be people like McCabe, who I mentioned already,
right,
or
McCabe,
Davies. That kind of motivation, the idea that idolatry and oppression are mutually complicit very often, is definitely there. And I think that's there in the Hebrew Bible as well. I mean, that's definitely there in the prophets, right? Talking badly about God and oppressing the poor and the widow characteristically tend to go together.
Mm-hmm. So in your mind then, so apophaticism actually helps theology in terms of getting rid of some of these really, really awful ideas that would lead to all sorts of sinful behavior.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
However, we do need to talk of God.
Yes.
And here I'm very, what I'm now going to say is distilled Aquinas. It's very, very standard. There are some things we say about God or purportedly about God. I mean, philosophers might ask if we're really whether this is really assertion at all, or whether we're engaged in some other language game, as philosophers would put it. There are some things we say that seem to be about God that aren't aimed at truth, if you like. They're part of our religious life, or they're providing us with helpful pictures, or they're inspiring us.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously fine. I mean, apophaticism leaves that alone. The way Aquinas and subsequent people have talked about this has been as metaphor. I don't think that's a particularly helpful term. I think it's metaphor tends to imply something a bit restricted, at least to philosophers. But right. I call this in my work devoted talk. So talk that is there for devotional reasons, but isn't necessarily aimed at truth as its primary objective. We can say true things about God's effects in the world. So there's this beautiful passage in Augustine's Confessions where he asks the sea whether it's God, and the sea denies being God, and asks fire whether
it's
God.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
And he gets kind of frustrated in the end because they say, I'm not God. And they say, in unison, he made us. Because he says at the end, what then can I say about God? And they say, he made us. So we can talk about God's effects in creation and in redemption. So for Christians, in the history of Israel and in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus, because this is happening in the created world, and I'm talking about things that my language is more equipped for. So the humanity of Jesus as opposed to, or as distinct from rather, the divinity of Jesus. Not a problem talking about that.
So apophaticism can at least give me some content in my theology of God created that, God created that, God created that.
Or God brings this about.
Right.
Yeah. So by miracle, the resurrection seems quite an important thing for Christians.
Yeah. Okay, because that's important, because a Christian worry would be, well, if I can't talk about God at all, can I really say he resurrected Jesus? And now you're saying an apophatic has no problem with this, because we can talk about the effects of God.
Has no more problems than anyone else.
Sure, it's exactly.
Kind of a dead person coming back to life is
because that's still
It's remarkable in a way that's not to do with my language and my concepts, if you like. And then, so what the standard response, but you might then reasonably want to say, but we want to talk about God in God's self.
Right.
You know, talking about God's effects or even God's humanity in Jesus is all well and good, but I want to talk about God qua God. I want to talk about God, you know, set the table. And if you open a standard introduction to the philosophy of religion, it will talk about something generally called classical theism, and this will involve saying a lot of stuff about God.
Right.
So God,
like omnipotent, God is good. Omniscient,
yeah,
all this
exactly.
stuff.
Yeah. And so I support what is a very standard route here, which is called analogy. And the idea of analogy is that because of my encounters with the created world, I am moved to say things truthfully, not just say things as a matter of poetry, say things truthfully about God as the creator of that world. And I do so using the only language I have available, namely a language equipped for talking about the created world. But when I reflect on this, I realise that the words I use can't have the same sense, but nor do they have a discontinuous sense. So I talk about God as good because God brings about creaturely goodness. So I say God is good. And when I say God is good, I don't mean something utterly distinct from what I might say when I say Ryan is good. So compare this with the word bank, right? In English, we use the word bank to mean those things beside rivers
right.
and financial institutions. There's no continuity there whatsoever.
Right. So if I say I'm going to the bank and I mean going to something next to a river, or if I say I'm going to the bank and I mean something next to a financial institution, well, then I'm using the word bank in two completely different ways. And so you're saying that's not analogy. Because analogy, there's got to be some similarity in the way the word is being used.
Exactly.
And so I can do this with God.
Yeah, yeah. You can do this. You can do this with God. Let's talk through the example. So God is good, not in the same way that you are, though. I mean, there's all sorts of your goodness, which I take to be a reality, is the kind of goodness human beings have, which is what we might call moral goodness. And that means you basically act as you ought to do. I mean, I think, and this is controversial in contemporary philosophy, but I think it's just unintelligible to talk about God acting as God ought to do, as though there were some sort of law.
Okay, so you want to say God, the idea of God having obligations, that just doesn't seem to make sense to you.
But what's common is that both you and God, and you at least in one respect, are everything you could be. There's no what Aquinas would call potentiality. You've done everything you can to be a good human being, and likewise, there's no lack of potentiality in God. Moreover, God brings about your goodness, so in a sense, we can say we see God in you, and it's appropriate to call God good in that way. So yeah, I'm not sure I want to say anything more at this stage, but basically we can say true things about God either by just by talking about God's effects, mm-hmm. Which is a religiously important way of saying true things.
Sure.
So Aquinas, when he talks about theology, says theology is the science that studies either God or things as orientated towards God.
Right.
So we can talk about the things as orientated towards God. And we can talk by analogy about God in God's self. And of course we can say what God isn't as well.
Sure.
Which is sometimes an important, useful and true way.
So there's a lot more content you can add to apophatic theology than it might initially seem.
It's if it was just a brute denial, that would be a problem, at least for a religiously involved apophatic theology.
Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine some academic in a room somewhere just asserting that we can't give a real definition of God and mm-hmm. She leaves it there.
And then there's nothing left to say.
There's nothing left to say. But we want, at least as a Christian theologian, philosopher, I want to be able to say the sorts of... I want to be able to assert the creed and mean it.
Sure.
Put it like
right.
that.
Yeah. And so in your mind, an apophatic can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. There's all sorts of footnotes and things.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
There always are.
Okay. So at this point, then, I want to move on to a particular mm-hmm. objection. I can imagine someone might complain that you're really not talking about God, but instead you're just talking about the word God. And so talking about the word God, like, it's not really what I'm interested in as a theologian. As a theologian, I hope that I'm actually talking about God and not just, like, the word God. So how do you think you would respond to an objection like this?
Well, I've had to, because it's not just an abstract theologian. Francesca Murphy, quite a significant Catholic
mm-hmm, yeah.
theologian, has made precisely that objection to precisely the people I was talking about earlier.
So like Herbert McCabe and Brian Davies, yeah.
I want to say two things. Firstly, I think talking about the word God is important to theology for precisely a reason I intimated in my answer to your previous question. Mm-hmm. So the theologian doesn't just talk about God. She talks about things as orientated towards God. And our language as used about God, creedally, liturgically, seems a really important example of such a thing.
Right.
So talking about God talk seems an absolutely fine thing for a theologian to do. Having said that, we do also want to talk about God, and I was saying that I think we can do that. But I do, in fact, think that we get a grip on stuff to do with God by looking at our language about God. And mm-hmm. I think that because I'm an analytic philosopher.
Right.
I think that language is really important, that we very often come to a better understanding of things outside of language. I would normally say things in the world. I'm not mm-hmm. quite happy with saying God's in the world.
Okay,
you know
sure.
what I mean.
Yeah,
things that are not words.
Mm-hmm.
By thinking about words. I mean, just think about how philosophers often talk about something like causation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we look at our use of causal language and say, ah, yeah, so we think about causation like that, and we think this kind of way of talking about causation is true, and therefore causation must be like that. That's a perfectly respectable way of undertaking philosophical investigations.
Yeah.
There's this enigmatic passage in Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations where he basically says much more elegantly what I've just said, and mm-hmm. he then puts in parentheses, theology as grammar. And I have no idea what's going on about
sure.
He was kind of into theology, but it doesn't make sense in context. But I think I'd want to take that and run with that. So grammar, not in the sort of tedious, you mm-hmm. know, this is a noun, this is a verb, but
sure.
serious attention to the way we talk, and therefore I would say the way we think, because mm-hmm. With the tradition going back to at least Frege,
yeah.
I think that kind of language discloses the way we think in an mm-hmm. important way.
So by studying the way I use words to describe reality, there's some sense in which I can understand, and maybe actually, these are actually pointing to something in the way the world is.
Yeah, I mean the
And so I can do the same thing with God. So even though you want to say God's not a part of the universe, but there's a sense in which God's part of reality.
God's certainly not part of language. Right,
right. Yeah. And so when I look at my language, I can say, well, maybe my language is actually pointing towards something true about God.
So,
in the same way about my language is pointing true about causation.
Exactly. So a really quite accessible resource, unusually accessible for the author,
mm-hmm.
is Michael Dummett's book, At the Foundations of Analytical Philosophy. So there he just lays out what he takes to be definitional of the kind of philosophical tradition I stand in. And it goes something like this. There's reality, and we relate to that by thinking about it. How do we understand our thoughts? Well, by looking at our language, because that's how we make our thoughts public. Mm-hmm. And there's this wonderful one-liner. He says, language may be a distorting mirror, but it's the only mirror we've got.
Right.
And that's basically my line. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just do not understand, to be slightly polemical. Mm-hmm. So Murphy in that book talks about something called metaphysical realism.
Sure, yes.
And if I can make sense of metaphysical realism, it seems to be the idea that I can get at reality other than through language. I just do not understand that. I lack that capability. So the fact that Herbert McCabe, for example, isn't somehow getting at God directly without linguistic mediation, it doesn't count against him, because not being able to do the impossible is not a fault.
Right. So in your mind, like, Francesca Murphy's argument really comes down to, well, if you can't describe God without using language, then you're not really describing God, just talking about God. And you're saying, How could I describe God without using language? As a human person, I am using language all the time. I can't describe things otherwise.
Yeah, and I can't. My concepts are so tied up with my use of language that I don't understand how I can, say, analyze my concepts, come to a better understanding of them, other than through looking at my use of words, our use of words better. It's not an individual thing. That's just the kind of things we were. There's a persistent temptation amongst religious people to imagine we're angels. We have direct, unmediated reality to... direct, unmediated access, rather, to God. We don't. Them's the breaks. We just have to be human, which is what we're created to be.
Yeah.
And part of what it is to be human is to be linguistic, I think.
Fair enough. All right, so I want to move on to another question here. So people who affirm apophaticism, sometimes they talk about the advantages that come with this position, and you alluded to a few earlier. So for example, someone might say that this approach really captures like a sense of awe that comes with experiencing the mystery of God. And when I think of someone like you mentioned earlier, Teresa of Avila, I mean, that's someone who really grasps the awe of God. But in some of your published work, you've identified some other advantages for apophaticism. So in one of your published papers, you claim it helps with the problem of evil. So why don't you tell me how apophaticism helps with the problem of evil?
Yeah, so the problem of evil is standardly set up in something like the following way. So you people who believe in God say that God is good. You also say that God is all-powerful, and you also say that God is all-knowing. But if that's right, how come there's evil in the world? Because if God's good, God would want to be able to get rid of evil.
Right.
And if God is all-powerful and all-knowing, God's got the equipment to do it. And this is not just in philosophy. I mean, this is out there in sort of the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins and stuff like that. I think the problem... I think we need to be careful in saying there's not a problem of evil, because I don't quite want to say apophaticism solves the problem of evil. I want to say that apophaticism shows that there isn't a problem of evil. It's what a certain type of philosopher would call therapy. It brings us to realize there's not a philosophical problem. But we've got to be really careful what we're saying there, because we could come across as monstrous. Of course there are very real problems with awful suffering in the world. It's just I want to say that they ought to be understood as pastoral problems or problems to be grappled with in prayer or liturgically or dealt with by political action to transform the world, stuff like that. What they are not is philosophical problems.
Right. Okay. So sometimes in contemporary discussions, we'll categorize the problem of evil as there's the logical problem of evil, which is there's some contradiction in thinking about God and the existence of evil. There's the evidential problem of evil, which is something about the kinds of evil we see give us a reason for thinking that God doesn't exist. And those are philosophical problems. And then sometimes we'll say there's the existential or the pastoral problem of evil, which is how do I personally deal with the suffering I've gone through and my relationship with God? And so you're saying, well, this apophaticism stuff, it can help with showing that these philosophical problems are not really philosophical problems. Existential pastoral stuff, that's a whole other issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's no philosophical therapy, nor are there glib answers to the latter. You know, they are hard and to be grappled with in fear and trembling, etc. But the first two, the ones that are, if you like, evil counts against the proposition that God exists.
Yes.
The apophaticist is going to say something like this, and indeed Brian Davies does say this in a series of books. You've got to be really careful by what you mean by God is good. The setup here seems to make it appear as though God's goodness is moral goodness, as though God is doing what God ought to do.
Oh, okay.
God is behaving like a good boy. So Dowie Phillips, in his book on the problem of evil, described a lot of the philosophical literature as providing end-of-term reports for God. You know,
okay, yeah.
God didn't do so well in this respect. Yeah. That was a bad famine, God, but thankfully you brought about some happiness over here. And that's not right. That's not what we mean by God's goodness. Indeed, there's a sense in which we don't know what we mean by God's goodness because we don't know what God is. We'll talk a bit more about that.
Okay.
So it's that kind of thing. It's because the apophaticist wants to be very careful that we understand that our use of words about God, even when they're intelligible and truthful, is distinct from our use of words about creatures. There is room for saying that, as philosophers would put it, there's a fallacy of equivocation here.
So
that you're setting off an argument that works if you're using words in a certain kind of way. But actually, if we examine the proper use of words about God, we're not using words in that way. And actually, I'd want to do very similar things about power and knowledge as well. So I'd want to say that Herbert McCabe used to say that there was a big problem of us taking God to be one of the gods with a small g, so making God a bit like Jupiter or Thor or something like that. You know, these big, powerful and quite volatile entities who were pretty much like ourselves and could be assessed in similar terms. I think a lot of the literature around the problem of evil
is doing something
in that
like
direction,
that. Which, I mean, fair enough, because Thor is pretty amazing, but Thor is not going to be the explanation for why the universe exists.
Quite.
And so someone like you or Herbert McCabe is going to say, you're not talking about the same thing here. So the way you're laying out the problem of evil, you know, we're talking about God as if he's Thor. That's not how God is at all. So this problem of evil you've set up, it doesn't actually attack God with a capital G.
Yeah, which is not to say that there aren't real problems when bad things happen to us, or when we're aware of the evil, injustice, and depression in the world, which is all too evident.
Okay, so let's move on to another question here. So if I understand the apophatic approach to God correctly, so you're saying that God cannot have any of the creaturely predicates or categories.
Yep.
And so this is what justifies the denial that God's a person, or that God's good in the sort of way, or God's knowledgeable in the sort of way that the problem of evil lays out. Well, I guess I've got a worry here at this point. So it seems to me like one would have to assume some knowledge of what is created and what is the creator. And I don't know, but personally, I'm not entirely certain about this. So for instance, when an apophatic might say that God is not a person or God is not temporal, they'll say that's because those are created things.
Yep.
But how do I know that those are categories, like that person and temporal, that they only belong to the created order?
So that is the question. There's a couple of positions that at least don't have this problem. Mm-hmm. So the position of someone, I don't know, quite well-known philosopher Richard Swinburne, who's pretty unworried, I think it's fair to say, about using words of God on the one hand, and Maimonides on the other,
okay,
who is just going to say you can't really talk truthfully about God. It's the kind of, as it were, middle way that appeals to something like analogy, as I have done, that may look unstable here. So let's make it even more unfavorable to me than you just have.
Okay.
So there are fluffy things in the world. There are rabbits, and there's my dog Lola. How do I know that fluffiness isn't predicated truthfully of God? How do I know that that's not something that can be said of the creator as well as of just creatures? After all, earlier on, I said that God was the cause of creaturely goodness, and we could therefore call God good. Well, God is presumably the creative cause of creaturely fluffiness as well. I mean, if God ceased to create Lola's fluffiness, she would cease to be fluffy. So why not, on that basis, say that God is fluffy. I can imagine a really terrible hymn, in fact, that says precisely that. And it might be a useful metaphor, but we don't want to say it. Well, remember I talked about talking negatively of God. So there are some things we have to deny of God in order for God to be the creator, in order for us to be talking about the creator. And complexity is going to be an important one. And complexity on this generous sense, which isn't just having physical parts, but is having, would include things like psychological complexity, would include things like difference between properties and substance. And then what you're going to have to do is look at predicates, look at bits of language that begin with is. So Ryan is good, Lola is fluffy, and say, well, does that predicate intrinsically involve complexity, the predication of complexity? So is it intelligible to say that something satisfies this predicate? This predicate is true of that thing if that thing is not complex in some way, even if that usage is stretched analogously. And there's going to be some that just don't. I mean, fluffiness seems utterly tied up with being physically extended,
right,
for example.
Right.
And I'm afraid I think personhood similarly is tied up with being complex, not necessarily in a physically complex way, but it's tied up with having distinct mental states. So my belief that I am happy is different from my belief that I'm sad and
okay,
stuff
so
like
this
that.
Is interesting, because when I think about some other apophatics like Brian Davies, if I remember correctly, he'll say, look, personhood is so completely tied up with being physical that I couldn't possibly predicate it of God. But you're going to say, well, actually, you know, even if I say I'm a soul, I still have complex mental states. And that's a kind of complexity that I can't say God has either.
I have some sympathy with Brian Davies' position. I mean, I think I learned to use the word personhood by encounter with material beings.
Sure.
And ourselves, exclusively, really. I do want to hold open that there could be persons who don't quite have physical complexity, but have some sort of complexity that is analogous to the complexity of a complex, reason-motivated animal such as ourselves. Mm-hmm. So the angels might be persons like this. But that's really saying they're kind of pretty like us, only the complexity is implemented differently, put it like that.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
That's very different from being God.
Mm-hmm.
That's merely not being material. I mean, there's a lot more to God than not being material.
Like, right.
The number two is not material. It's
right.
Not God.
Right. Yeah. Number two can't really do anything, have any effects,
it's very
and
boring.
It wouldn't be the explanation for why the universe exists.
It's not good at parties.
No, it's not. Okay, so I've got one more worry for us to look at here.
Yeah.
So what would prevent an apophatic from saying that goodness, power, and knowledge all belong to the created order and thus must be denied of God? Because my worry here is that the apophatic would really force me to deny that God is omnibenevolent or omnipotent or omniscient, and those are pretty standard claims from classical theists.
They are. So the answer, the form of the answer now is going to be tediously predictable, right? So
yeah.
I'm going to say that what we mean by goodness, power, and knowledge, when we use those words of God, is dissimilar in some respects, at least, from what we mean when we use them of ourselves. Fine, you might say, well, why use them at all? And the answer is going to be creation. God is the creative cause of absolutely everything other than God that exists at every moment of that thing's existence. So distinguish sort of creator theism here from deism. So deism is kind of the view that God winds up the universe at the beginning and lets it run. Aquinas, who I follow here, doesn't take that view. Indeed, he doesn't think it's obvious that the universe has a beginning at all.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
He believes that weirdly. Weirdly, because he generally isn't a biblical literalist. But
right.
He thinks it's taught in the book of Genesis that the universe has a beginning, because in the beginning God created heaven and earth.
Right.
So but there were a bunch of people who thought it didn't, and he thought he couldn't argue with them as a philosopher. But he thought he could argue as a philosopher that the universe was created. Why? Because there's still this question, why is there something rather than nothing at all?
Exactly.
Which is can be asked of anything at any point.
Yeah.
So because God is intimately present as creator to absolutely everything, at every moment in time and can cease to bring it about and can create freely. I mean, that will do for omnipotence.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems pretty much like something we want to call omnipotence.
Sure,
We've talked about goodness. Now, knowledge is interesting. I do not think God has propositional knowledge.
Okay.
I think there's also... So very often philosophers will think of knowledge... Well, we'll think of a certain type of knowledge like
right.
this. There are things called propositions, which are abstract objects.
Mm-hmm.
And when I know that 2 + 2 = 4, I stand in a particular relation to an object, the proposition that 2 + 2 = 4, and that's knowledge because, hurrah, 2 + 2 = 4,
right.
and I've formed my beliefs well. Say I've proved it using, that's not why I believe it because my school teacher taught me, but anyway, which is a good reason to believe things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's knowledge. Well, that can't be what's going on with God. I mean, firstly, God's standing in this sort of non-creating relation to an external object sits uncomfortably, I think, with simplicity. But also this proposition, I mean, does God create that? If not, there's something God didn't create.
Mm-hmm.
If so, well, does it pre-exist God? That, you know...
There's some weird questions that pop up that
really
classical
weird.
Theism doesn't really right. like to... Yeah.
So just here's how God knows that God 2 + 2 = 4. God knows that 2 + 2 = 4 in the following sense. God creates the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And God is... God knows that. There's this beautiful bit in Aquinas. He says he uses a word that you'd best translate, I think, probably as rustic or something like that. But
okay.
let's say God knows the universe as the potter knows the pot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more intimate form of knowing that isn't propositionally mediated.
Right. Yeah.
God doesn't have to justify God's beliefs. God doesn't have to somehow prove that 2 + 2 = 4. And God just brings it about that P is the case, and therefore God knows that mm-hmm. P. Sorry, this is it's a dreadful way philosophers talk sometimes.
No, but it helps highlight a particular point within classical theism, which is the claim that God knows things by knowing the cause of the things. And the cause is himself.
Yeah. Right.
So he
yeah.
knows things by knowing himself.
Yeah.
And it's not propositional.
It's not propositional at all. So it's kind of... there's a whole load of problems that I gesture towards with this mm-hmm. weird thing of... What if God knows propositions? They just vanish. So again, really, it's kind mm-hmm. of therapeutic mm-hmm. apophaticism here.
Oh, by showing that there's not a bunch of philosophical problems here mm-hmm. at all.
But it's kind of also, it highlights the religiously important nature of God's knowledge. I mean, so Augustine in particular talks a lot about God's knowledge of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that being, it's kind of there in scripture as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know my inmost parts.
Which is not non-propositional knowledge. It's this intimate knowledge you're talking about by acquaintance of some sort. Yeah.
And it's just that God has that sort of, we might... appropriately use that sort of language of ourselves, say our knowledge of our spouse or something like
mm-hmm.
that. God has that kind of knowledge of electrons and numbers and everything.
Yeah.
Because absolutely everything is created by God, other than God's self.
Okay, so in that sort of way, I can talk about clearly God's got power, clearly God has some kind of knowledge. And so... again, the apophatic can say, I've got theology, I've got content here to my theology.
Yeah, and nor is it nothing inferentially. I mean, so God's plans, as it were, are not going to be thwarted by God having insufficient knowledge.
Right.
That would be strange.
Yeah.
But that's because God, if you like, creates the stage on which the drama... of creation and redemption is played out,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And is the prop manager and absolutely everything.
Sure, yeah.
There's no surprises from God's point of view.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I've got one final question here for you. So what originally got you interested in the topic of apophaticism, and why do you think it's important for theologians and philosophers to continue to affirm it?
Oh, right, that's really interesting. So... another gratuitous Wittgenstein quote. I've already got one in. So
mm-hmm.
Wittgenstein, he's good for quotes. Wittgenstein says that a philosophical puzzle has the form, I don't know my way around. Some kind of
mm-hmm. okay.
suddenly things confuse or scare me.
Yeah, yeah.
And really that on two counts. So there were kind of philosophical and then political motivations. So I came at philosophy of religion whilst also studying theology and also with significant political and ethical commitments. And there was just this puzzle that the stuff the philosophers were saying was very often quite different from the stuff the theologians were saying. Mm-hmm. And the problems philosophers thought there were, not just with things we've talked about like the problem of evil, but stuff to do with incarnation and Trinity, for example, just were not there for theologians. And that was because the theologians were talking about gods in a significantly different way. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought it was important to, but that makes it sound too sort of one-sided. That makes it sound like the theologians were sort of being wonderful and the philosophers were being tin-eared. But the philosophers were far more careful and rigorous in their approach to things, and that was sorely lacking on the
on the theological side.
So so I thought it would be kind of interesting to think about the stuff the theologians were talking about in the way the philosophers were thinking. So in a way, it was just a product of my academic biography. But also, I am quite seriously motivated by this stuff that was important to McCabe and others to do with the potential political bad consequences of having inadequate conceptions of God. Feuerbach has this thing that Marx then engages with of God being, as Feuerbach sees it, the projection of unfulfilled human potential.
Right.
So there's this kind of trade-off between human beings and God. And of course, the apophatic theologian wants to say, that can't be right, because anything that can compete with human beings like that is not God.
Right.
But nonetheless, I do think we, in actual fact, very often do project things onto God in quite dangerous ways. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's something I do regularly, and then sometimes that really has big political and ethical implications.
Absolutely. And I think the intersection between politics and religion has come onto the world stage again this millennium for good. Sadly, largely for bad. And that deserves attention from philosophers and theologians, because there's a lot of people with very bad motivations talking about this stuff. And even the people with good motivations very often just lack the skills to talk about it coherently or in ways that will be persuasive in religious communities. So I think even if I weren't intellectually interested in this stuff, there would be a certain ethical imperative for at least some. I'm not saying like everyone should give up working stop working on ethics, come and talk about apophatism.
Sure.
But at least some people ought to be thinking about this, I think.
So you think with like something like the current political context, apophaticism is really important because somebody needs to stand up and say, look, you're using God to justify your politics. God's not like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even need to fully buy my my stuff. I think it is important that the biblical and patristic tradition, put it like that, of denying the gods in the name of God is out there and out there. And, you know, the gods, they're not like Moloch or Baal or anything any longer. They're like the nation or money, things like that. And that's bad. And then even when people appear to be talking about God with a capital G, very quickly sort of God's on the side of this group of, this ethnically defined very often, group of people who I like, and applauds us when we trample down other groups of people. And we you know, the practice of denying all too creaturely things of God. Because that one, I mean, you know, the it's tempting to project one's best attributes onto God.
Sure.
It's not even, the idolatry is not even that good very often. Mm-hmm. It's projecting our absolutely worst attributes onto God. So yeah, I think there is a task in just articulating those denials. And perhaps, you know, the kind of argument to do with creation I sketched at the beginning of this podcast might be helpful for that, if it is good.
All right, well, thank you very much. It's been a very fascinating conversation today.
Oh, no, thank you. It's been fun. It's good.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for episodes on impassibility, passibility, and so much more.